Yemen is different. That was what was so important for me to convey as a journalist to an American audience, that Yemen is different, that the humanitarian suffering in Yemen absolutely surpasses anything I have ever seen in my career. I have covered Syria, I have covered Afghanistan, I have covered Somalia, Iraq, South Sudan. I have covered many, many wars, and what is going on in Yemen is an utter catastrophe. And the danger, like basically the cliff that the country is edging towards in terms of the famine, is something that it just shocked me that wasn't being talked about.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I'm a documentary filmmaker and National Geographic explorer. And on this show, I interview the world's best storytellers about how they craft the stories they tell. My guest this week is Jane Ferguson. Jane is a Beirut-based special correspondent working for the PBS NewsHour. She reports from across the Middle East, Africa, and beyond, often working in conflict zones. Some reporting highlights include frontline dispatches from the war against ISIS in Iraq, an up-close look at Houthi-controlled Yemen, and reports on the war and famine in South Sudan. On top of her work at the PBS NewsHour, Jane also writes for various outlets, including The New Yorker. And before PBS, she reported extensively for Al Jazeera English and CNN International. In this conversation, Jane and I discuss her journey from correcting spelling errors at a newspaper in Dubai to now working for the PBS NewsHour. We talk about her 2018 reporting trips to cover the ongoing war in Yemen, and we also dig into the impact she hopes to have in the world when she puts her life on the line to bring us these untold stories. I'm very excited to share this episode with you all. There were multiple times in the interview and also when I was listening back to it during the edit where I got chills. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Jane Ferguson. Jane, thank you so much for joining me all the way from Beirut. It's so great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah. So how long have you been living in Beirut?
Beirut, it will be 5 years this coming spring. Okay. I've been in the region for 11 years. I was based in Dubai before, but bouncing all over. But yeah, this will be my fifth summer coming up.
Okay. What is one of your favorite things about living in Beirut?
Very easy to answer right now because we have a big storm outside, and that means in the mountains we have snow. We get to go skiing in the winter here, and it's only about an hour's drive out of Beirut City, sometimes 45 minutes if there isn't much traffic. Mm-hmm. And that's fantastic. We get to drive up there for the day, go for a bit of a ski, and come back home again. And also just generally being in a Mediterranean culture is fantastic. It's just lovely.
Yeah. Like, what does that look or feel like?
It's very family-oriented, food-oriented, you know, definitely work to live, relaxed, beachy, lots of local food products, lots of great local culinary sort of uniqueness, as well as just a very sort of lovely, you've got the arid landscapes, lots of olive trees and palm trees, but then also, of course, the Mediterranean Ocean.
In 2017, I got to go to Beirut for the first time, and I was really, like, pleasantly surprised at just, like, how beautiful the nature was there, from the mountains to the sea to... I got to see the cedar trees in person.
Oh, wonderful.
It's very magical.
Yeah, and it's great for hiking up there as well. Yeah. And people are so lovely. People are incredibly friendly. So, it's certainly not the impression people get, especially in America. Everyone says, oh my God, you live in Beirut. That must be terrifying and dangerous. Most of the time I'm at farmer's markets and on the beach.
Cool. So I'd love to start this conversation looking a little bit at your background, and we'll kind of work our way towards what you're doing today for the PBS NewsHour and writing for The New Yorker. So to start, I'd love to hear, when did you first develop an interest in journalism?
I was fortunate enough to grow up in a house where I grew up in Northern Ireland, and, you know, in the UK and Ireland, there is a real interest in journalism and a real keen appetite for foreign news as well. So I did grow up in a house where, you know, international papers were the international section of the national papers was read widely. My parents had, you know, National Geographic and the Sunday Times, the Times of London. And so I was kind of surrounded by that. Also just culturally, 9 o'clock news, 6 o'clock news every night. This was something that was just a big part of our daily routine. And I just, admittedly, I had a bit of wanderlust from a very young age. I was obsessed with maps, and I just would absorb biographies and autobiographies of travelers and adventurers. And I have to admit that being a journalist did seem to like getting paid for traveling and seeing interesting things and meeting interesting people. I've also always been a bit of an international affairs nerd and a big junkie, news junkie. And I just love the idea of being able to be kind of nosy and at the center of things, seeing it for myself. So that was what initially kind of interested me.
Was there a moment that kind of made you interested in getting in international news, or is that something that just kind of was ingrained in you and with how you grew up? And
it's hard to know. I mean, these moments, I don't think we recognize them when they come. I think that we look back and see them retrospectively. I do think when I look back, I did read the Sunday Times, the Times of London. Their Sunday magazine used to come out, and it had at the time, and would have been the early 90s, really high quality photojournalism. And I do remember seeing photographs from the wars in the Balkans and being quite shocked by them, but also just absolutely intrigued by the fact that what was going on over there was so visual, and that I could see it for myself in my own living room. So that was of real interest. And then, of course, there were journalists that inspired me. And in the UK, we had Kate Adie, who was a very famous war correspondent for the BBC. Mm-hmm. And so there were role models when I looked into it. I do remember feeling inspired when I read about women like Gertrude Bell and Kate Adie and many, many female journalists that had gone before.
Mm-hmm. So what was your first job that you had in journalism?
Well, I was lucky enough to graduate into the big global recession. So it was 2007 when I left college.
And lucky you.
I mean, it was unbelievable. Like newspapers were folding. I mean, if you remember, everyone was discussing this was the end of the business. Radio was finished. Newspapers would be no more. TV channels were laying off literally hundreds of staff at a time. And here I am walking around with my CV, my resume, and I don't even have any experience other than student journalism at this point. So I just couldn't get a job. And my best mate and I had worked together at the student newspaper. She was the editor-in-chief at the university I went to in England. And we couldn't find jobs, and we both realized that to get jobs, we'd have to go abroad. And she went off to Mexico City to freelance out of there. And the war on drugs was very much so a hot subject there and a really, really crucial story. So she got a string there with a major British paper, and I took a job in Dubai. So there was an English language newspaper there. It was the biggest one in the Middle East at the time, the biggest English language paper. And they were hiring because the recession hadn't hit the Persian Gulf yet. And they were paying jobs. And my first job was as a sub-editor on the sports section. I may have been a little creative in the interview about my interest in sports. So I ended up, effectively what my job was to correct spelling mistakes, like really just proofread for like obvious, you know, issues and make it fit in the page and write a headline, a suggested headline. And then the editor of the section, who actually knows about cricket, would change the headline. So that's what I would do all day. Mm-hmm. That was my first ever job.
Gotcha. And at that time, did you, I know from seeing you on TV these days that you speak Arabic. Were you thinking about Did you already know Arabic before you went to the Middle East, or were you thinking this will be a great chance for me to learn while I'm working in an English newspaper? Or
sure. Well, I kind of jumped ahead of myself there a little bit. I took a couple of classes at college thinking I'm going to learn Arabic without initially realizing how incredibly difficult it is. So group classes, I think I learned a few words. So actually, before I went to Dubai, before I got a job in Dubai, when I was kind of flailing around and couldn't find a job, I actually went to Yemen to study Arabic.
Okay.
And I spent 4 months in Yemen at the very start of 2008 after finishing some internships, which were great, but didn't turn into jobs because no one was hiring. So I moved to Yemen and basically enrolled at one of the Arabic schools there that a lot of Westerners used to go there to study. And I was fortunate enough to be able to spend some time there. So by the time I did get to Dubai, I had a fair grasp. I didn't speak the local dialect that is sort of spoken in the Gulf, but I had sort of started along the path of learning Arabic.
Mm-hmm. And when you had this kind of vision for your future and, or maybe this goal in mind of, I want to be telling stories related to international news, did that correlate with you thinking, I want to report from conflict zones? Or is that something that kind of just naturally happened as you were in that region?
I think, you know, I've never really been an adrenaline junkie. I think what drove me in those younger years when I was just imagining the job rather than doing it, what drove me was this idea that I would be at the center of the main stories of the day. And when I was growing up, those were in war zones. They were typically in the Balkans. They were typically in the Middle East. I was, you know, whenever 9/11 happened, I was still in high school. So then there was Afghanistan and Iraq, and all through college, you know, that's when that was going on. So for me, it was that's where the center of things seemed to be. And I always wanted to be at the center of things. Mm-hmm. So for me, you know, conflicts, unfortunately, you know, bad news, tends to seem to dominate the news agenda. But wars are very urgent news matters. So I think that also when it comes to the Middle East, that's where a lot of the news stories were in the post 9/11 world. I mean, I think when I was really young and imagining my life, I thought of it as something a little bit more like out of Africa and Meryl Streep's life there. And I would live in Kenya in some fabulous house and travel around Africa. So, you know, things change because the news agenda changed. So, So I guess that's the best answer I can give you on that one.
Mm-hmm. So in prep for this interview, I stumbled upon a speech you gave at one of your old schools, Lawrenceville School.
Yeah.
That was on YouTube. And one of the things that caught my attention that you talked about in that speech was you were talking about the grit that you needed when you were first getting started and when you were doing those first jobs. And I think that struck me just kind of based on where I am in my career right now, knowing that, you know, looking for kind of entry level jobs at different documentary production companies. And no, I might not be doing the thing that, you know, I see as my future, but it might take some of that grit. So I know my circumstance is a lot different than the jobs you were doing, but I'm curious, like, what did you mean by grit? Like, what does that mean to you? And then why was it so important during those days, maybe when you were working in the sports section in Dubai or freelancing?
Yeah.
Freelancing, I think, after that.
I think, you know, that speech, of course, I was giving at my old high school, and I'm talking to teenagers, so I'm aware that I'm talking to kids who don't know yet how hard it is to get into a really competitive. So I'm kind of almost talking to them about something they can't quite understand. I'm just trying to connect. For you, for someone who's just out of college or in college or, you know, out of college a few years, but it's still very, very, you know, tough to see how you're going to get to where you want to go, I think you understand much more clearly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's the grit for me. It's almost like a active faith. You know where you want to be, but you can't really see how you're going to get there. You simply have to get up every morning having a faith that somehow you will get there. And, you know, I didn't have connections in the industry. I don't have, I come from a small farm in Ireland. I don't know people. I don't know how it all works. I have no corporate experience. So for me, I was very much so feeling my way in the dark and just trying to basically follow every lead that I could career-wise. Mm-hmm. And very often, like many times in my career back in those days, 2008, 9, 10, 11, those were the really tough years before I got a really regular gig that was sustainable and that I could make a living from and really focus on the journalism. Those years, very often my career was kind of dangling by a thread. It would be hanging on this one pitch I'd sent to one editor. And if that didn't come through, I literally had no idea what I would do. So there were so many times where I had to simply have faith that if I kept trying and knocking on doors and talking to people and coming up with ideas and innovating, that I would be able to move forward. And the grit comes where you have to be willing to accept that you might inch forward very slowly. And that's really scary. That's really scary because we grow up believing that we, you know, we'll get entry level jobs and then we'll move our way up through companies. And the world doesn't work that way anymore. The economy doesn't work that way anymore. And certainly journalism doesn't, that, you know, that there's this one very clear road pathway to the job that you want.
Mm-hmm. So in those early days that we're talking about there, was there a story you did that you felt like you were starting to get it, like you were starting to do what you wanted to do? And I'm trying to kind of sense the connection to like when you started working at PBS. I'm sure it was kind of like a long road, but is there maybe a time period or a certain piece that you really felt like you were starting to nail it?
Yeah, I feel as though, you know, when you look back at your career, there are several of those, you know, because they're all different levels. Mm-hmm. You know, there are times where you suddenly feel like I started as a newspaper reporter and I struggled very much so with television writing. My scripts were newspaper scripts. They didn't work. They weren't immediate. They were passive. They weren't active. The way that I was writing, the way I was crafting them was like a newspaper article read into a microphone. And so it took me a very long time to really get how to write scripts. And I had, before working at Al Jazeera, I was working, I was sort of on contract on a retainer with CNN International. Mm-hmm. And I was had an executive there in Atlanta. I'd flown over to Atlanta, who gave me some advice that was just, you know, with 15 minutes sitting down with this guy, he was able to explain to me what, like, to really understand writing to the pictures that you have and how to craft a visual story. And I left and I went to South Sudan shortly afterwards and I got it. I suddenly, something clicked into place and it just made my life a little bit easier. And there have been so many moments like that. When it came to live reporting, I spent a year in Afghanistan as the Al Jazeera English correspondent, every day almost on the roof of our bureau at a live shot position going live, you know, basically not just, you know, no teleprompter, of course, live reporting, analysis, extended updates. And, you know, those were moments where I would come away from a live shot position feeling like I hadn't just ummed and ahed my way through the last 10 minutes of TV. So there have been lots. At PBS, much, much more so. It's been now, you know, several years of magazine length crafting of, I would say there's been no greater learning period in my career than these years at PBS.
That's fantastic.
Because it is so difficult to craft a magazine length piece of television to do it well. It's very easy to do it fine, but it's very difficult to do a great job of storytelling. And like you say, the craft of how to build a narrative, have your characters in there, and at the same time, you are just doing news reporting and you're working in the most difficult environment possible. So
yeah.
I would say it's taken me about 3 years to really start to feel like, yes, I can do this.
So what are some of those things that you feel like move a story that you're working on these days from fine to great?
I had a mentor, I have a good friend and mentor who's been very helpful at explaining to me, you know, the difference between lining up elements, as we would call them. Of course, an element, you know, just being an interview or a place or a scenario, instead of just jumping from one to the next, basically building the narrative. So unpacking a story. I'm aware that I'm incredibly privileged to have, you know, up to 10 minutes for a piece. This is just an unbelievable luxury of time for a TV reporter. But I feel like I have a responsibility to take those 10 minutes and not just have elements lined up and then this and then this and then this and then this. Instead, I have to, there's this sweet spot of marrying a personalized character-driven story to a larger narrative, and then also managing to bring it back. So I'll start, very often I'll try to start with a place or a person, and then I try to unpack it from there. And you're trusting the viewers to just go with you on this because they don't quite understand what's going on, maybe for the first couple of minutes or why. And then, you know, we have to be able to marry the context and the bigger geopolitical story into it, and then continue on with the story and perhaps revisit that character. One of the ways I really like to do that very often, simply because it does reflect the way that I work, the way that I think most foreign correspondents work, is it's a journey. Very often it's, you know, we're here and then we're going here, and it's for a reason that we're telling the story in this way. So I try to, that way you can draw your viewers in again. The danger or the difficulty is making sure that it doesn't just go completely off script and then just continue to ramble and continue to unpack. At some stage, you have to stop unpacking the geopolitics and then put it all back in again.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's hard to really get that right.
So I'd love to maybe ground that sense of story in one of your recent reporting trips. So specifically, I'd like to look at the reporting you've done in Yemen in 2018. And did you go there two times last year, like two trips?
Yes, I went in June and December.
Right, right. So maybe you can kind of walk us through the process of, so let's say your first trip to Yemen. So for the listeners, Jane did an amazing three-part series called Behind Rebel Lines from Yemen, which she went to in June. And Jane, maybe you could walk us through the process of, like, you know, how does this, from kind of start to finish, from pitching the story or like developing contacts to getting in the country to filming that B-roll, and then we'll kind of get into the building of the narrative again.
Sure. I mean, Yemen, it's worth mentioning, is a special case. Not all of my work is like that. And thank goodness, because it would be very hard for me. But, you know, I had been in and out of Yemen repeatedly for years, ever since I had lived there in 2008. I'd reported from there for Al Jazeera, for CNN, and for PBS back shortly after the rebels had taken over the north. I had spent the last 2 years not being able to get back in. We would get granted visas, but you weren't allowed into the country. You couldn't board any flights into the rebel-held capital, or the capital of Yemen. So journalists, I mean, couldn't board flights. And so normally, like 98% of the way I work is I would pitch to PBS, pitch to my boss, and then I would go somewhere on a commission for them, and we would agree a budget, we would agree the stories, you know, roughly within reason. You have to work with what you find on the ground, but and then we would agree a timeline. For me, I didn't know if I could pull this off, so because nobody had managed to be in since the blockade had really begun of the area. I mean, there was a PBS frontline team, a fantastic team, that managed to get in about 18 months before, or slightly less than that before. And they were the last journalists to be allowed on a flight. And then everybody was stopped. So this was a big experiment. And I worked for a long time with my fixers, two different fixers, talking to them about how to get in and what would we do. And
these are fixers who live in Yemen.
Yes. Right, well, one of them was actually technically exiled out of Yemen at the time, but
has lots of contacts.
Yeah, and are Yemeni. So I, in the end, decided to go by myself. So I was not commissioned, and to see if I could make it work. And I went. So I flew to the southern, or the sort of the capital of the south, really, in Aden, which is under the control of the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition of, that's a military coalition of Arab states that support a Yemeni government in the south. And I flew in there and then basically had to smuggle myself across the front line north. And it was due to some very brave and very wonderful Yemeni friends and contacts that managed to get me north. And so once I got north,
so the people who picked the people who picked you up at the border are like contacts of your fixers.
Yes.
Who?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Right.
So I'll be. I mean, I literally get in a car, fully niqabed with the full headdress, face veil, everything, and just drive north, pretending to be a Yemeni. And then once you get across, you can cross the front line. At the time, it was peaceful. There wasn't any fighting at the specific area that I crossed. So we just drive down the road, and then we get to the to the rebel held areas. And that's where I will be met by my contacts from the north who've driven halfway down to pick me up. And I'll basically be handed over to them. And I spent some time there. Like, you know, I wasn't sure how the rebels would receive me. Like, would they let me film anything? You know, you know, it's a nightmare situation. But you know yourself, you could show up somewhere and you just can't, like, they won't let you film this. They won't let you film that. It's a nightmare. So after a few days of filming, I reached out and started to craft these stories with my editor at PBS.
Okay,
and
so when you first went in, it was just you with a camera. You didn't have a camera person with you or anything.
Yeah, I decided to travel alone. I think trying to, the cameraman I work with regularly, or there's several of them, they're all men, all very non-Yemeni looking American and Italians. And I decided it was safest to go alone. And so I hired a cameraman when I was there. I didn't even bring, I brought nothing. I had a small, good quality microphone hidden at the bottom of my rucksack just in case there was no decent audio there.
Okay.
And, you know, and I bought a brand new iPhone, a fancy iPhone, so that I could have a second camera for B-roll. And that was it. And I hired a very lovely, very good Yemeni cameraman when I was there. And, you know, he didn't speak any English, and so I was, you know, and my Arabic's not bad, so it was a lot of brain power the whole time trying to talk the whole time, but we made it work. And then I kind of had leave to stay. Also, I think because for the first time I wasn't on commission, I had given myself the freedom of time, because it takes so much time. You have to spend days drinking tea, having meetings, agreeing something, and then they'll renege on the promise, and then you'll have to drink more tea, and it's just it's a lot of negotiation. And when I'm on assignment for PBS, you know, understandably, like, we're public television, we don't have bottomless budgets, so, you know, and I'm paid a day rate, so I can't, so the budget doesn't run a month long for me to make sure I can film the best possible elements. So there's always in the back of your mind this idea that you're going to run out of time. Whereas by going by myself, I could budget so that I could stay longer.
And what's the balance of how much you have the stories planned out or envisioned before you go into these conflict zones versus what you just find when you get there?
It totally depends on the story.
Okay.
I would say, and I do notice this more with my colleagues who don't live in the region, there can be an unrealistic expectation for how much you can actually set up before you come out. And that it's a bit of an anxiety, because when you're pitching a story, you're kind of thinking, well, you know, hopefully I'll get this. So, you know, there's no guarantees, but I would say, in reality, 80% of it is done on the ground. You know, trying to get people to, it's a cultural thing as well. People don't say, okay, in 4 weeks' time, we will do this. You know, instead, you know, and also, like, it's also part of the more polite Arab culture as well, and society, that when you show up somewhere, you know, you have to go and sit and drink tea, perhaps have lunch, perhaps have dinner, and talk to people about what it is that you want. It's seen as quite sort of perhaps aggressive, cold and unfriendly to just call up and demand it on the phone first. So, you know, you can get 90% more done when you're there. So I would say, you know, you can try your best, talk to your fixers and your contacts and tell them what you want. But ultimately, I end up explaining what I want again the moment I arrive at almost everywhere I go.
Yeah, right. And what does kind of your mental process look like when you're weighing the value of the story versus the risk of going to get it?
It's a really good question. And it's a really, I think it's a question that makes a lot of journalists, particularly those who cover conflicts, feel conflicted about, because the truth is that, you know, you do make a calculation. Like, you know, there are places, we call them thankless stories, where, you know, it's incredibly dangerous and it is probably going to make air, you know, way down the line. It may not, you know, you may not get as much airtime for it or as much interest. You know, some people have said Yemen is a thankless story, but for me, Yemen is a very personal, personal story for, you know, as a place that I have a connection with. It was the first ever place I went to in the Middle East. I lived there and I feel very passionate about that story. But there are plenty of other conflicts that people are not covering because, you know, you'll find editors will say it's too dangerous. But at the same time, the reality is that we do also cover Iraq. We do also cover Syria, you know, these sorts of things. I'm fortunate enough to not deal with that very much at PBS, because at PBS, and I'm not just saying this because, you know, my boss might hear it, but it is true that we do love to cover uncovered stories. But I know that colleagues who would love to be covering other uncovered stories just, you know that having that conversation, like people at the networks, you know, it's very difficult to persuade a foreign editor or an executive to give you a shot at covering a conflict like Central African Republic or South Sudan, where the danger is very, very high. But perhaps people will say, where? Right. What conflict? Whereas people will take these risks. I mean, by the time, I know that eventually everybody stopped because of the kidnappings and the danger. But I mean, journalists were going into rebel-held Syria, you know, into places like Aleppo and Idlib, like very, very long into the conflict, taking huge risks. But we don't take those risks in South Sudan and in the Central African Republic or in Somalia. And, you know, that's a reality, unfortunately, for a lot of the media coverage of conflicts. You know, we don't cover the Congo. These are dangerous places, but so unfortunately, that is a calculation, a risk to reward calculation that journalists do have to make. And for me as a freelancer, because I'm still technically a freelancer, I also have to pitch stories that people want to make a living. But I am fortunate that I do get to cover quite a few uncovered stories. Like I was able to go to South Sudan with support of the Pulitzer Center. But that's definitely something that's really difficult for war reporters to kind of almost come to terms with themselves, because it almost feels on a personal level like an ethical issue as well. Because, you know, who's to say what story is more worthy of the risk?
So when you were in Yemen in that first series that we've been talking about, one of the, or I think of like the two of the three stories you did focused a lot on the U.S. involvement, how the U.S. is implicated in this war there. Out of all the kind of angles that you could have looked at this from, why did you want to look at that when you were there? Yeah.
I think for any reporter, especially foreign correspondent, what really attracts people or what kind of pushes our buttons is reporting things that are underreported. And what really struck me, and certainly I've seen since that piece aired, how, you know, the reaction from the viewers has certainly reinforced this, is that people simply don't know. You know, I mean, the people are very, very unaware of the US's involvement in many conflicts, whether, you know, when I was reporting in this time last year, I was in Somalia reporting on US involvement in Somalia and the sort of ramping up of the numbers of US troops on bases inside Somalia. But for me, the reason it was so important in Yemen, even more so than perhaps a lot of other places I've reported from, is that not only was the US military's involvement very much so opaque and hush-hush and not known, and to an extent hidden from the public, mm-hmm. but also the consequences of this war on the population was also not known. So you really had several layers of a story that were not heard of or understood or seen, literally seen, in the United States. So you had, there you have U.S. military involvement, and then you also have a war that is causing a famine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was very well aware that there was a campaign, a particular effort to keep journalists away from these images because these images are not really very convenient for those who wish to continue the support for the war, because there was a push to keep journalists out because the consequences of the war would highlight the US's involvement in a war that is hurting an awful lot of people.
Is that different than most conflicts? Like, I would think that in most conflict zones, they would not want journalists there.
Actually, it depends. You know, I mean, we've seen, I certainly know myself and many other conflict reporters found it very difficult to gain access to U.S. military presence in places like Somalia, in other places in sub-Saharan Africa, in Syria. It's been extremely difficult. That's partly that's technical. Partly that's because the U.S.'s military footprint is massively increasingly special forces, and special forces are not media friendly. So right. that's a technical issue, but Yemen is different, and I think it's very important. That was what was so important for me to convey as a journalist to an American audience, that Yemen is different, that the humanitarian suffering in Yemen absolutely surpasses anything I have ever seen in my career. I have covered Syria, I have covered Afghanistan, I have covered Somalia, Iraq, South Sudan. I have covered many, many wars, and what is going on in Yemen is an utter catastrophe. And the danger, like basically the cliff that the country is edging towards in terms of the famine, is something that it just shocked me that wasn't being talked about.
And how did that affect you personally, seeing that?
I think, you know, I think that for conflict, in my personal experience as a conflict journalist, I think that, you know, we all associate trauma with bang bang and with combat reporting. In my experience, that can shake you up a fair bit, but it tends to fade faster than a sort of lingering sadness. I think that, you know, to be a journalist, to be a good journalist, you have to be empathetic. You have to be authentic in your interactions with people, because I think authenticity is the most important element of journalism. And to be authentic, you really do have to really, really connect with people. And so you are a little bit of a sponge, a bit of a trauma sponge. And so it always feels rather indulgent to say, because these people are suffering in a way that you couldn't, you know, possibly, you'll never ever experience what it feels like to watch your child starve to death. But at the same time, you are thinking to yourself afterwards, actually, I do feel rather emotionally exhausted and very, very sad. And it does take a little while for you to sort of recognize that and just honor that and allow yourself to feel what you're going to feel. Because I think when you're in the field, you have to, for me, I feel like I have to be a little bit protected. I have to be thinking and working and planning. And so I tend to process when I come home.
Maintain some emotional kind of distance while you're there, just so you can do the job the best you can.
Yeah, but you have to acknowledge to yourself that you really didn't keep that much of a distance. Like you still absorbed it, you still saw it, you still felt it. And yeah. So you have to give yourself time to allow yourself to feel it. It's almost like a delay mechanism. You know, if you walked into a hospital ward and you saw a starving child that was on death's door, you'd go, oh my God, that's so awful, and start crying. If you're a journalist, you might walk into that hospital and do your job and then cry 2 weeks later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when you get back and you're putting your stories together, is your goal to make the viewing audience feel what you felt in those moments?
My goal is definitely to make them connect. Like, for me, this has always been what the journalism has been about. I take the word communication very literally. Like, we have to commune. So I don't want the viewer to just look at a starving baby and say, oh, that's really awful. Isn't that terrible? Look at that baby. I want a viewer to look at this family and understand that they are humans and that they have this, they love their kids just like anybody else. They react to crises just like anybody else. So for me, what's important is that they can see a shared humanity in those people, not just that they see it and feel bad. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that really makes sense. And it kind of makes me think of, you know, I love I think your most recent story was the one from the orphanage in Yemen. And I actually had thought of a question about how, like, it seems like a number of your stories, you're often showing kids or speaking to kids. And I don't know, like, I always feel that, like, that sense of humanity and that sense of connection, especially when I see and hear from kids. There's something about that for me. But yeah.
Well, that's good. Like, that's, you know, that's really what you want. You want people to feel like that there's a connection. And it's a really, as a journalist on camera in these stories, it's a very, very delicate balance. You know, I do believe that being on camera, I can help tell the story and walk the viewer through it. But it's not my job to sort of talk over people, you know, be the center of the story and sort of patronize the viewer as well, like, and explain it to them as though they're stupid. I have to very gently kind of introduce the viewer to this little guy, this little, you know, 8-year-old kid who's lost his dad, and like help just sort of try to be in the, you know, not in between the viewer and that kid. I'm just trying to introduce this conversation with them. It's not easy, but it's made easier if you genuinely are listening to what people are saying. I think that's probably the most important part of being authentic in the field, is when you do interviews, like, actually listen to what people are saying, sit with them and actually let them speak. Don't have an idea in your head of what kind of sound bites you need and want. Just actually allow people to talk. And I think that translates on camera to the viewer listening to them too.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when you've been in the field, you've identified the story or the angles, and you've gathered all the B-roll and on-camera speaking that you can, and then we can look back at these Yemen stories we've kind of been using as an example. Then you go back to Beirut, and that's when you're doing all the post-production?
Most of the time, most of the time after the fact, I'll sit down and write a script and put it together. I try more and more to be scripting whilst I'm on the road, because I'm logging footage, I'm thinking of what we have, and it's fresher in my mind. Like, for instance, if I'm walking through an orphanage, just sort of a line of a script will just come into my head, you know, or in a hospital ward, or when I'm on the road. And so I do jot those down in my phone, in my notes. I jot down little notes and then I start to build it. So I try not to leave too much time between writing a script and actually filming the piece, because I, I, I think that you can forget the feel of it, the sound of it, the smell of it.
Yeah.
So I prefer to arrive home with a script, you know, in my laptop. But I'm only one person, so I'm often doing so much that I'm just too exhausted. But I do the edits typically back home.
Yeah. And what's the editorial process like for a story like Yemen, where you have such challenging images? Are you going back and forth with PBS of like, hey, this needs to be in there? I know it's hard for people to see, but this needs to be there.
In my most recent trips, actually, PBS has been very, very open to what I want to do. Like, they've not pushed back on any of the imagery. And there was in the main hunger story that I did in December on this trip, there was one little girl at the very top of the piece, and called Ikram, and she was 4 years old, and she's like the worst case of malnutrition I've ever seen in my career. And she was, you know, the nurses examine them, and these children, they take their clothes off, and their little bodies are just skeletons, and you know, it's a very, very shocking to see. And I did include like 90% of the shots that I'd taken in the piece, and actually in PBS didn't push back on any of that at all. They aired it as is, and I really respected that. I'm not sure many other news organizations would have. I think there would have been a little bit of nervousness about it. Mm-hmm. And we didn't, to my knowledge, we didn't have any complaints. Interestingly, the same video I put up on Instagram and Facebook, and Facebook initially took it down. And then after I appealed, they quickly put it back up again. So, but in this case, PBS they aired it exactly as I'd sent it. So, they were very keen. I mean, in the newsroom, in the headquarters, in DC, there's a real sense of importance of this story, and a real sense of urgency, and a sense of having to tell this story the way that we do, and the way it needs to be told. So they were very supportive.
And you mentioned that you are afforded a lot of time to tell these stories compared to what most reporters get, for especially for TV news. What does that allow you to do? Like I guess that's my question.
It allows context. You know, I've never bought this idea that the public don't understand foreign news. Mm-hmm. That they don't understand Shia Sunnis, that they don't understand the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, that they don't, you know, it's not true. They won't understand that if you tell it to them in 90 seconds. I wouldn't understand it. And I'm a Middle East correspondent. So I love the fact that I can put context in and help people understand why this is important, why it's happening, and give people that grounding of the story. The other really important thing more airtime does is it allows you to actually humanize people. You know, I can't do what I was discussing with you earlier about helping people connect. I can't do that whenever I can't really tell people's stories and put sound bites in. Like, for instance, in May of last year, I went to Gaza, and I was reporting on the protest movement there that was sort of the protesters were rushing the border, and the Israeli forces were firing. And there were many, many deaths the day that I was there, because that was whenever the U.S. embassy was being moved from Tel Aviv up to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So to tell that story, I went to the home of one of the protesters and sat with him and his family and talked a lot about the socioeconomic conditions in Gaza. You know, I filmed these people in their home. I filmed their home. I can't do that in 90 seconds. So in many ways, the shorter timings, it actually dehumanizes a lot of our subjects and the people that we're talking to, our characters. And you know, we cut their sound bites so short that we literally take away their voice. Wow. So I'm very grateful to be able to show people these characters as human beings that talk and have a house and a life and a job and a family.
Right.
So That, yeah. That takes time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely feel that. And it's why, and I'm not just saying this because of speaking to you, but it's why PBS NewsHour is the only television news I watch, because I feel that as a viewer.
Well, that's really encouraging because you are, you know, young. You're not a kid, but you're young, and you're not the stereotypical kind of what we might think of as the stereotypical PBS viewer. And I think that young people want context. They want these longer pieces. Magazine length reporting, like, you know, 6 to 10 minutes, I think is really the future of in-depth, you know, foreign news reporting, because I think it's a misconception that millennials need, you know, shiny objects and don't have any attention span. I actually think whenever you look at programs like Vice on HBO, you know, that format of the longer story is working. Even the Vice News, the more newsy show, their pieces are 4.5 minutes long. You know, that's very, very long for news. So, you know, there's clearly an appetite for people to actually listen to a real story.
So you see kind of that you think that that shift might continue, like things might get a little bit longer. And for people who might want to be international correspondents, in what other ways do you think that the landscape has shifted and may continue to shift, whether that is the danger, which is very real for journalists out there, or the amount of international correspondence, which I believe has gone down over the past couple decades? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Actually,
but... Well, in terms of staff, yeah. I think that, you know, a lot of, you know, news organizations have shut up bureaus. And so the idea that you'll go in as a staff youngster and you'll work your way up is very, very difficult to see now. There's loads of freelance opportunities. It's just very, very difficult. And that's going to continue. It's difficult to make a sustainable income from it. It's very difficult to really live. That's a bit tricky, but I know it's cliched, but for young people getting into the business, you know, you really do need to know how to film, edit, take pictures, write, and go on camera, you know, do live updates, the ability to do everything. And, you know, it's very difficult because, like me, you're just going to have to learn on the job unless you get into a news organization. But I think that's going to increasingly be the minority. I think that young freelancers are going to continue to grow in numbers as opposed to staffers. I think that, you know, for young people trying to get into the business, what I see a lot more of, especially here in Beirut and places like this, is a lot of those younger freelancers flocking to the same place. Advice I would give, and I have given many times, is, you know, fun as it is to live in Beirut and be on the Mediterranean or be in Nairobi and enjoying the Kenyan lifestyle, you do sometimes have to pick a story that's slightly undercovered and make it your own.
Right.
Find a story that you're passionate about that you think news organizations will take stories from once in a while. You just need them to bite once in a while. They're not going to call you every day. Be realistic. But if you can find a story that you really can care for and can devote some time to, 6, 12 months, 18 months of your life, like, do that. Do something and do it well rather than sort of trying to go with the big stories. If you show up in Baghdad and there's a major breaking news story, everybody has their own people there already. But right. if you're working somewhere like the Congo, covering a more uncovered story, the Congo is really dangerous. I'm not encouraging young people to go there and report if they don't have experience. But say, for instance, you go somewhere like Greece and you start covering migrant issues you know, stories like that. Try to find somewhere where you can really breathe and learn to be a storyteller. I think geography is half the battle.
Very cool. We talked a little bit about what you hope your audience gets when they watch your stories or read your stories. And then I also want to ask about, like, impact from your stories, whether that's policy or what kind of actions you want people to take. Is there an impact that you hope your stories are having? And is there an example of an impact that you've been really proud of?
I think I think as a journalist, I do have to remember that I'm not an activist. So there is a line there where it's, I think we want our stories to have impact. Of course, we want our stories to alleviate suffering. We want our stories to inform the public so the public can make good choices. This is the nature of democracy. We are informing the public for a reason. And so it always makes me feel happy whenever we, and the lovely viewers of PBS do actually reach out a fair bit and email me. And it always makes me feel happy when people say, you know, we didn't know about that, we didn't know about this, but we're going to contact our representatives, that, you know, we're going to contact our senators or our congressmen and women, and we're going to express our views on this now and let them know what we think about this. Mm-hmm. That is, I think, a reminder of the role that journalism plays in democracy, in terms of, provided that your reporting is really balanced and fair and is, you know, we don't use the word objective anymore because I think that it's kind of become rather, it's become kind of beyond the pale of usefulness. But I think so long as your reporting is professional and accurate and fair, then I think that the impact that it has can only be good. And if it has, and so that's basically what I'm saying in terms of our viewers looking at what we're broadcasting and then saying, well, I didn't know about this, but now I'm going to make sure that this is part of my consciousness when I make choices as a citizen of a democracy. That's the best that I can hope for. You know, we also, you know, we all, it's difficult because as journalists, I think when we're really, really young and you're thinking about becoming a journalist, I think sometimes it's easier to think that your work will make more of a difference. But the truth is, when you're actually a journalist, your work makes a difference in this very, very slow, glacial way. And you don't always see it. And it can be kind of disheartening. Look, I'd love to prevent a famine in Yemen, but I have to go home and live with the fact that I don't know if I can do that. I don't know if I am, I don't always see the difference. And I think that's one of the bigger challenges for war reporting, that you go home and you hope that you make a difference, but you don't always. There's a whole generation of reporters now who risk their lives to tell the world that, you know, Syrians were being slaughtered by their own government. And I think that was a very difficult realization over the last few years trying to understand, did the reporting make a difference? The war in Syria killed nearly 500,000 people so far. So I think that, you know, I would, without meaning to be kind of too doom and gloom and jaded about it, I think that for younger people getting into journalism or wanting to get into journalism, I think you need to be prepared for the fact that your reporting is that will become a small personal contribution that you've made to informing the public, and, you know, it won't always be some big Watergate moment.
Right. Absolutely. And it reminds me, like, I've had one of my first big projects internationally that I did was I did this story about how hydroelectric dams along the Mekong River in Southeast Asia are impacting communities there, and spent 7 weeks there. And once the story came out, I was coming kind of to terms with the realization that, like, yep, very few people are going to read this. Like, I can't imagine anyone's going to, like, go act upon it. But what I kind of came to terms with in that space was, if my stories can just give people a little bit more perspective on life, that was huge for me when I was young, when I was reading, like, Nicholas Kristof's work.
Yeah.
You know? Just that perspective, and it's a perspective that has moved me to now be doing the work that I'm doing today. So, so before my last question, Jane, if people want to follow your work, follow you on social media, where should we send them?
Well, you can send them to Twitter, JaneFerguson5, and to Instagram. I'm Janie Ferg. On Instagram. That's probably the best place. But also just keep watching PBS NewsHour. Keep watching PBS NewsHour and you'll see great reporting from all of the correspondents. We have also, going into an election year, we have an incredibly brilliant, smart team of journalists covering the White House and Capitol Hill. And yeah, just keep watching the news hour. And if you don't want to sit through an entire hour of news, because it's a lot of time, just watch it on YouTube. Watch all the segments online. So that's definitely the best way.
I will second that. The YouTube is great. I often will be cooking, and I will have the YouTube version of the news hour.
Oh, that's so nice. Well, yeah. I would plug my website right now, but I haven't updated it in about a year, so you're reminding me. That was on my January things to do list. So I am journalistjaneferguson.com, but yeah, I have a lot of updating to do on there. So just give me a few weeks.
Cool. All right. And so the question that I'll end on is, a lot of the people I speak to on this show and journalists who I admire, one of the things I admire about them is they're continually developing their craft as storytellers, continuing to push the envelope and develop. And so I'm actually want to end this episode by asking you, in what ways do you want to develop your craft? Where are you hoping to improve moving forward?
Oh, it's a good question. Loads of ways. I've always said, and even now, like I've been doing this job for over 10 years, if you're not a much better journalist every 6 months, then you're not doing something right. Like you're always getting better. For me, I would say looking towards this year, I'd really, really like to get my writing a little bit more, I think just a little bit more eloquent. Sometimes I'm a little bit, I sort of say it as it is, and then I'll show my script to someone, and they'll be like, well, I think you're understating what you're seeing because you're in the story. So that's what I'd like to work on. I'd like to get my writing to be a little bit more evocative. Mm-hmm. And I would also like to be able to, it's just sort of perhaps boring and technical, but my sound editing is not where it should be. I tend to be like, oh, pictures. Oh, they're so fabulous. And then, okay, let's just send it. And, I do need to take those extra 3 or 4 hours to really, really finesse the sound. And it's very boring and important, so I have to do it. So I'll be more disciplined with that, because sound is just such an important hidden element to TV. It really makes a piece pop if it's sound edited well.
Well, I love that. Even at the top of the game, always striving to improve. So thank you for indulging me with that question.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I really enjoyed our chat.
Yeah, me too. Thanks so much. That's it for episode 14 of the Austin Meyer Podcast. Thank you so much to Jane Ferguson for coming on the show, and to all the listeners out there. Go show her some love on social media. Let her know what you thought of the episode, what really resonated with you. Again, that is Jane Ferguson 5 on Twitter and Janie Ferg on Instagram. I think what I appreciate so much about Jane, and I think it's also why I really enjoy reading memoirs from war correspondents or journalists who work in conflict zones, even though I don't have that desire to do that work, I find that the people who do that work are so introspective and thoughtful about how they tell stories and what they want their impact to be in the world. And I think that's because to do that job, to do what Jane does, you cannot go through the motions. Because if you go through the motions doing that job, there's a high likelihood that you will die. And I think that working under those conditions really forces someone to be deeply introspective and thoughtful about the work they do. And I feel like that came across to me in that interview with just how thoughtful Jane was. And I hope to have more people who are thinking deeply on the show, just like her. So if you enjoyed that episode, please consider sharing it with a friend or reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts. And if you're interested in being even more a part of the show with the chance to have your questions answered by guests like Jane, check out my new Patreon page at www.patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. Patreon is a membership platform where you can pledge as little as $1 a month to help support the show. And in return, you'll get some sweet perks on the back end, like asking questions to my podcast guests and becoming a part of a private community of storytellers on Facebook. So check that out, patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. And with that, I will see you next week. Go out and tell some stories.